Side 6, Sphere, by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 236. The squid moved forward. They could see each other in the glow through the portholes. It's starting, Norman thought.
This time we can't.
Tentacles swung against the habitat.
Jerry!
Ted shouted. His voice was high, strained with tension. The squid paused. The body moved laterally, and they could see the huge eye staring at them.
Jerry, listen to me!
The squid appeared to hesitate.
He's listening,
Ted shouted, and he grabbed a flashlight off a wall bracket and shined it out the porthole. He blinked the light once. The great body of the squid glowed green, then went momentarily dark. Then glowed green again. He's listening, Beth said.
Of course he's listening. He's intelligent.
Ted blinked his light twice in rapid succession. The squid blinked back twice. How can he do that? Norman said.
It's a kind of skin cell called a chromatophore, Beth said. The animal can open and close these cells at will and block the light.
Ted blinked three times.
The squid blinked three times.
He can do it fast, Norman said.
Yes, fast.
He's intelligent, Ted said. I keep telling you, he's intelligent and he wants to talk.
Ted blinked long, short, short. The squid matched the pattern.
That's a baby, Ted said. You just keep talking to me, Jerry.
He flashed a more complex pattern, and the squid answered, but then moved off to the left.
I've got to keep him talking, Ted said.
As the squid moved, Ted moved, skipping from porthole to porthole, shining his light. The squid still blinked its glowing body in reply, but Norman sensed it had another purpose now. They all followed Ted, from D into C cell. Ted flashed his light. The squid answered, but still moved onward.
What's he doing?
Maybe he's leading us.
Why?
They went to B cell, where the life support equipment was located. But there were no portholes in B. Ted moved on to A, the airlock. There were no portholes here either. Ted immediately jumped down and opened the hatch in the floor, revealing dark water.
Careful, Ted.
I'm telling you, he's intelligent, Ted said.
The water at his feet glowed a soft green.
Here he comes now.
They could not see the squid yet, only the glow. Ted blinked his light into the water. The green blinked back.
Still talking, Ted said. And as long as he's talking.
With stunning swiftness, the tentacle smashed up through the open water and swung in a great arc around the airlock. Norman had a glimpse of a glowing stalk as thick as a man's body, and a great glowing leaf 5 feet long swinging blindly past him, and as he ducked, he saw it hit Beth and knock her sideways. Tina was screaming in terror. Strong ammonia fumes burned their eyes. The tentacle swung back toward Norman. He held up his hands to protect himself, touched slimy, cold flesh as the giant arm spun him, slammed him against the airlock's metal walls. The animal was incredibly strong.
Get out! Everybody out! Away from the metal!
Fletcher was shouting. Ted was scrambling up away from the hatch and the twisting arm, and he had almost reached the door when the leaf swung back and wrapped around him, covering most of his body. Ted grunted, pushed at the leaf with his hands. His eyes were wide with horror. Norman ran forward, but Harry grabbed him.
Leave him! You can't do anything now!
Ted was being swung back and forth in the air across the airlock, banging from wall to wall. His head dropped. Blood ran down his forehead onto the glowing tentacle. Still, the arm swung him back and forth, the cylinder ringing like a gong with each impact.
Get out! Fletcher was shouting. Everybody out!
Beth scrambled past them. Harry tugged at Norman just as the second tentacle burst above the surface to hold Ted in a pincer grip.
Off the metal! Damn it, off the metal!
Fletcher was shouting, and they stepped onto the carpet of B-Sill, and she threw the switch on the green box, and there was a hum from the generators, and the red heater banks dimmed as 2 million volts of electricity surged through the habitat. The response was instantaneous. The floor rocked under their feet as the habitat was struck by an enormous force, and Norman swore he heard a scream, though it might have been rending metal, and the tentacles quickly drew down out of the airlock. They had a last glimpse of Ted's body as it was pulled into the inky water
and Fletcher yanked down the lever on the green box. But the alarms had already begun to sound, and the warning boards lit up. "Fire!" Fletcher shouted. "Fire in E-Sill!" Fletcher gave them gas masks. Norman's kept slipping down his forehead, obscuring his vision. By the time they reached D-cylinder, the smoke was dense. They coughed and stumbled, banged into the consoles. "Stay low," Tina shouted, dropping to her knees. She was leading the way. Fletcher had stayed behind in B. Up ahead, an angry red glow outlined the bulkhead door leading to E. Tina grabbed an extinguisher and went through the door, Norman right behind her. At first, he thought the entire cylinder was burning. Fierce flames licked up the side padding. Dense clouds of smoke boiled toward the ceiling. The heat was almost palpable. Tina swung the extinguisher cylinder around, began to spray white foam. In the light of the fire, Norman saw another extinguisher, grabbed it, but the metal was burning hot, and they dropped it to the floor. "Fire in D," Fletcher said over the intercom. "Fire in D." Jesus, Norman thought. Despite the mask, he coughed in the acrid smoke. He picked the extinguisher off the floor and began to spray. It immediately became cooler. Tina shouted to him, but he heard nothing except the roar of the flames. He and Tina were getting the fire out, but there was still a large burning patch near one porthole. He turned away, spraying the floor burning at his feet. He was unprepared for the explosion, the concussion pounding his ears painfully. He turned and saw that a fire hose had been unleashed in the room, and then he realized that one of the small portholes had blown or burned out, and the water was rushing in with incredible force. He couldn't see Tina. Then he saw she had been knocked down. She got to her feet, shouting something at Norman, and then she slipped and slid back into the hissing stream of water. It picked her up bodily and flung her so hard against the opposite wall that he knew at once she must be dead. And when he looked down, he saw her floating face down in the water rapidly filling the room. The back of her head was cut open. He saw the pulpy red flesh of her brain. Norman turned and fled. Water was already trickling over the lip of the bulkhead as he slammed the heavy door shut, spun the wheel to lock it. He couldn't see anything in D. The smoke was worse than before. He saw dim patches of red flame hazy through the smoke. He heard the hiss of the extinguishers. Where was his own extinguisher? He must have left it in E. Like a blind man, he felt along the walls for another extinguisher, coughing in the smoke. His eyes and lungs burned despite the mask. And then, with a great groan of metal, the pounding started, the habitat rocking under jolts from the squid outside. He heard Fletcher on the intercom, but her voice was scratchy and unclear. The pounding continued, and the horrible wrenching of metal. And Norman thought, "We're going to die. This time, we're going to die." He couldn't find a fire extinguisher, but his hands touched something metal on the wall, and Norman felt it in the smoky darkness, wondering what it was, some kind of protrusion. And then 2 million volts surged through his limbs into his body, and he screamed once and fell backward. Aftermath. He was staring at a bank of lights in some odd angled perspective. He sat up, feeling a sharp pain, and looked around him. He was sitting on the floor in D cylinder. A faint, smoky haze hung in the air. The padded walls were blackened and charred in several places. There must have been a fire here, he thought, staring at the damage in astonishment. When had this happened? Where had he been at the time? He got slowly to one knee and then to his feet. He turned to E-cylinder, but for some reason the bulkhead door to E was shut. He tried to spin the wheel to unlock it. It was jammed shut. He didn't see anybody else. Where were the others? Then he remembered something about Ted. Ted had died, the squid swinging Ted's body in the airlock. And then Fletcher had said to get back, and she had thrown the power switch. It was starting to come back to him. The fire. There had been a fire in E-cylinder. He had gone into E with Tina to put out the fire. He remembered going into the room, seeing the flames lick up the side of the walls. After that, he wasn't sure. Where were the others? For an awful moment, he thought he was the only survivor. But then he heard a cough in C-cell. He moved toward the sound. He didn't see anybody, so he went to B-cell. Fletcher wasn't there. There was a large streak of blood on the metal pipes, and one of her shoes on the carpet. That was all. Another cough from among the pipes. Fletcher? Just a minute. Beth emerged
grease streaked from the pipes. Good. You're up. I've got most of the systems going, I think. Thank God the Navy has instructions printed on the housings. Anyway, the smoke's clearing and the air quality is reading all right. Not great, but all right. And all the vital stuff seems to be intact. We have air and water and heat and power. I'm trying to find out how much power and air we have left. Where's Fletcher? I can't find her anywhere. Beth pointed to the shoe on the carpet and the streak of blood. Tina? Norman asked. He was alarmed at the prospect of being trapped down here without any Navy people at all. Tina was with you, Beth said, frowning. I don't seem to remember, Norman said. You probably got a jolt of current, Beth said. That would give you retrograde amnesia. You won't remember the last few minutes before the shock. I can't find Tina either, but according to the status sensors, E-cell is flooded and shut down. You were with her in E. I don't know why it flooded. What about Harry? He got a jolt too, I think. You're lucky the amperage wasn't higher, or you'd both be fried. Anyway, he's lying on the floor in C, either sleeping or unconscious. You might want to take a look at him. I didn't want to risk moving him, so I just left him there. Did he wake up? Talk to you? No, but it seems to be breathing comfortably. Color's good, all that. Anyway, I thought I'd better get the life support systems going. She wiped grease on her cheek. I mean, it's just the three of us now, Norman. You, me, and Harry?
That's right. You, me, and Harry.
Harry was sleeping peacefully on the floor between the bunks. Norman bent down, lifted one eyelid, shone a light in Harry's pupil. The pupil contracted. This can't be heaven, Harry said. Why not? Norman said. He shone the light in the other pupil. It contracted. Because you're here. They don't let psychologists into heaven. He gave a weak smile. Can you move your toes, your hands?
I can move everything. I walked up here, Norman, from down in C. I'm okay.
Norman sat back. I'm glad you're okay, Harry. He meant it. He had been dreading the thought of an injury to Harry. From the beginning of the expedition, they had all relied on Harry. At every critical juncture, he had supplied the breakthrough, the necessary understanding. And even now, Norman took comfort in the thought that if Beth couldn't figure out the life support systems, Harry could. Yeah, I'm okay. He closed his eyes again, sighed. Who's left? Beth. Me. You.
Jesus.
Yeah, you want to get up?
Yeah, I'll get in the bunk. I'm real tired, Norman. I could sleep for a year.
Norman helped him to his feet. Harry dropped quickly onto the nearest bunk.
Okay if I sleep for a while?
Sure.
That's good. I'm real tired, Norman. I could sleep for a year.
Yes, you said that. He broke off. Harry was snoring. Norman reached over to remove something crumpled on the pillow beneath Harry's head. It was Ted Fielding's notebook. Norman suddenly felt overwhelmed. He sat on his bunk, holding the notebook in his hands. Finally, he looked at a couple of pages filled with Ted's large, enthusiastic scrawl. A photograph fell onto his lap. He turned it over. It was a photo of a red Corvette. And the feelings just overwhelmed him. Norman didn't know if he was crying for Ted or crying for himself, because it was clear to him that one by one, they were all dying down here. He was very sad and very afraid. Beth was in D-cell at the communications console, turning on all the monitors. They did a pretty good job with this place, she said. Everything is marked. Everything has instructions. There are computer help files. An idiot could figure it out. There's just one problem that I can see.
What's that?
The galley was an E-sill, and E-sill is flooded. We've got no food, Norman.
None at all?
I don't think so.
Water?
Yes, plenty of water, but no food.
Well, we can make it without food. How much longer have we got down here?
It looks like 2 more days.
We can make it, Norman said, thinking.
2 days, Jesus. 2 more days in this place.
That's assuming the storm clears on schedule, Beth added. I've been trying to figure out how to release a surface balloon and see what it's like up there. Tina used to punch some special code to release a balloon.
We can make it, Norman said again.
Oh, sure. If worst comes to worst, we can always get food from the spaceship. There's plenty over there.
You think we can risk going outside?
We'll have to, she said, glancing at the screens. Sometime in the next 3 hours.
Why?
The mini-sub. It has that automatic surfacing timer. Unless someone goes over and punches the button.
The hell with the sub, Norman said.
Let the sub go.
Well, don't be too hasty, Beth said. That sub can hold 3 people.
You mean we could all get out of here in it?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Christ, Norman said. Let's go now.
There are 2 problems with that, Beth said. She pointed to the screens. I've been going over the specs. First, the sub is unstable on the surface. If there are big waves on the surface, it'll bounce us around worse than anything we've had down here. And the second thing is that we have to link up with the decompression chamber on the surface. Don't forget, we still have 96 hours of decompression ahead of us.
And if we don't decompress, Norman said. He was thinking, let's just go to the surface in the sub and throw open the hatch and see the clouds in the sky and breathe some normal Earth air.
We have to decompress, Beth said. Your bloodstream is saturated with helium gas in solution. Right now you're under pressure, so everything is fine. But if you release that pressure suddenly, it's just the same as when you pop the top off a soda bottle. The helium will bubble explosively out of your system. You'll die instantly.
Oh, Norman said.
96 hours, Beth said. That's how long it takes to get the helium out of you.
Oh. Norman went to the porthole and looked across at DH-7 and the mini-sub. It was 100 yards away. You think the squid will come back? She shrugged.
Ask Jerry.
Norman thought, no more of that Geraldine stuff now. Or did she prefer to think of this malevolent entity as masculine? Which monitor is it?
This one. She flicked it on. The screen glowed.
Norman said, Jerry, are you there?
No answer.
He typed, Jerry, are you there? There was no response.
I'll tell you something about Jerry, Beth said. He can't really read minds. When we were talking to him before, I sent him a thought, and he didn't respond.
I did too, Norman said. I sent both messages and images. He never responded.
If we speak, he answers. But if we just think, he doesn't answer, Beth said.
So he's not all-powerful. He actually behaves as if he hears us.
That's right, Norman said. Although he doesn't seem to be hearing us now.
No, I tried earlier, too.
I wonder why he isn't answering.
You said he was emotional. Maybe he's sulking.
Norman didn't think so. Child kings didn't sulk. They were vindictive and whimsical, but they didn't sulk.
By the way, she said, you might want to look at these.
She handed him a stack of printouts.
They're the record of all the interactions we've had with him.
They may give us a clue, Norman said, thumbing through the sheets without any real enthusiasm. He felt suddenly tired.
Anyway, it'll occupy your mind.
True.
Personally, Beth said, I'd like to go back to the ship.
What for?
I'm not convinced we've found everything that's there.
It's a long way to the ship, Norman said.
I know, but if we get a clear time without the squid, I might try it.
Just to occupy your mind?
I guess you could say that. She glanced at her watch.
Norman, I'm going to get a couple of hours of sleep, she said. Then we can draw straws to see who goes to the submarine.
Okay. You seem depressed, Norman.
I am.
Me too, she said. This place feels like a tomb, and I've been prematurely buried. She climbed the ladder to her laboratory, but apparently she didn't go to sleep, because after a few moments he heard Tina's recorded voice on videotape saying, "Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?" And Beth replied, "Maybe. I don't know. It scares me."
The whir of rewinding and a short delay, then, "Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?"
"Maybe. I don't know. It scares me."
The tape was becoming an obsession with Beth. He stared at the printouts on his lap, and then he looked at the screen. "Jerry," he said, "are you there?" Jerry did not answer. The sub. She was shaking his shoulder gently. Norman opened his eyes.
"It's time," Beth said.
"Okay," he yawned. God, he was tired.
"How much time is left?"
"Half an hour." Beth switched on the sensory array at the communications console, adjusted the settings. "You know how to work all that stuff?" Norman said. "The sensors?"
"Pretty well. I've been learning it."
"Then I should go to the sub," he said. He knew Beth would never agree that she would insist on doing the active thing, but he wanted to make the effort.
"Okay," she said. "You go. That makes sense."
He covered his surprise.
"I think so, too."
"Somebody has to watch the array," she said. "And I can give you warning if the squid is coming."
"Right," he said, thinking, "Hell, she's serious."
"I don't think this is one for Harry," Norman said.
"No, Harry's not very physical, and he's still asleep. I say let him sleep."
"Right," Norman said. "You'll need help with your suit," Beth said.
"Oh, that's right, my suit," Norman said. "The fan is broken in my suit."
"Fletcher fixed it for you," Beth said.
"I hope she did it right."
"Maybe I should go instead," Beth said.
"No, no, you watch the consoles. I'll go. It's only 100 yards or so anyway. It can't be a big deal."
"All clear now," she said, glancing at the monitors.
"Right," Norman said.
His helmet clicked in place, and Beth tapped his faceplate, gave him a questioning look. "Was everything all right?" Norman nodded, and she opened the floor hatch for him. He waved goodbye and jumped into the chilly black water. On the sea floor, he stood beneath the hatch for a moment and waited to make sure he could hear his circulating fan. Then he moved out from beneath the habitat. There were only a few lights on in the habitat, and he could see many thin lines of bubbles streaming upward from the leaking cylinders. "How are you?" Beth said over the intercom.
"Okay. You know the place is leaking?"
"It looks worse than it is," Beth said. "Trust me." Norman came to the edge of the habitat and looked across the 100 yards of open seafloor that separated him from DH-7. "How does it look? Still clear?"
"Still clear," Beth said. Norman set out. He walked as quickly as he could, but he felt as if his feet were moving in slow motion. He was soon short of breath. He swore.
"What's the matter?"
"I can't go fast."
He kept looking north, expecting at any moment to see the greenish glow of the approaching squid, but the horizon remained dark.
"You're doing fine, Norman. Still clear."
He was now 50 yards from the habitat, halfway there. He could see DH-7, much smaller than their own habitat, a single cylinder 40 feet high with very few portholes. Alongside it was the inverted dome and the minisub.
"You're almost there," Beth said. "Good work."
Norman began to feel dizzy. He slowed his pace. He could now see markings on the gray surface of the habitat. There were all sorts of block-printed navy stencils.
"Coast is still clear," Beth said. "Congratulations. Looks like you made it."
He moved under the DH-7 cylinder, looked up at the hatch. It was closed. He spun the wheel, pushed it open.
He couldn't see much of the interior because most of the lights were out. But he wanted to have a look inside. There might be something, some weapon they could use.
Sub first, Beth said. You've only got 10 minutes to push the button.
Right. Norman moved to the sub. Standing behind the twin screws, he read the name. Deep Star 3. The sub was yellow, like the sub that he had ridden down, but its configuration was somewhat different. He found handholds on the side, pulled himself up into the pocket of air trapped inside the dome. There was a large acrylic bubble canopy on top of the sub for the pilot. Norman found the hatch behind, opened it, and dropped inside. I'm in the sub. There was no answer from Beth. She probably couldn't hear him, surrounded by all this metal. He looked around the sub, thinking, I'm dripping wet. But what was he supposed to do, wipe his shoes before entering? He smiled at the thought. He found the tapes secured in an aft compartment. There was plenty of room for more, and plenty of room for 3 people. But Beth was right about going to the surface. The interior of the sub was crammed with instruments and sharp edges. If you got banged around in here, it wouldn't be pleasant. Where was the delay button? He looked at the darkened instrument panel and saw a single flashing red light above a button marked Timer Hold. He pressed the button. The red light stopped flashing and now remained steadily on. A small amber video screen glowed. Timer reset, counting 12-0-0-0-0. As he watched, the numbers began to run backward. He must have done it, he thought. The video screen switched off. Still looking at all the instruments, a thought occurred to him. In an emergency, could he operate this sub? He slipped into the pilot's chair, faced the bewildering dials and switches of the instrument array. There didn't seem to be any steering apparatus, no wheel or joystick. How did you work the damn thing? The video screen switched on. Deep Star 3, command module. Do you require help? Yes, no, cancel. Yes, he thought. I require help. He looked around for a yes button near the screen, but there wasn't any that he could see. Finally, he thought to touch the screen, pressing yes. Deep Star 3, checklist options. Descend, ascend, secure, shut down, monitor, cancel. He pressed ascend. The screen changed to a small drawing of the instrument panel. One particular section of the drawing blinked on and off. Beneath the picture were the words, Deep Star 3 Ascend Checklist. 1. Set ballast blowers to on. Proceed to next. Cancel. So that was how it worked, Norman thought. A step-by-step checklist stored in the sub's computer. All you had to do was follow directions. He could do that. A small surge of current moved the sub, swaying it at its tether. He pressed the cancel, and the screen went blank. It flashed. Timer reset, counting 11:53:04. The counter was still running backward. He thought, have I really been here 7 minutes? Another surge of current, and the sub swayed again. It was time to go. He moved to the hatch, climbed out into the dome, and closed the hatch. He lowered himself down the side of the sub, touched the bottom. Out from beneath the shielding metal, his radio immediately crackled. You there? Norman, are you there? Answer, please. It was Harry on the radio. I'm here, Norman said. Norman, for God's sake! In that moment, Norman saw the greenish glow, and he knew why the sub had surged and rocked at its moorings. The squid was just 10 yards away, its glowing tentacles writhing out toward him, churning up the sediment along the ocean floor. Norman, will you... There was no time to think. Norman took 3 steps, jumped, and pulled himself through the open hatch into DH-7. He slammed the hatch door down behind him, but the flat, spade-like tentacle was already reaching in. He pinned the tentacle in the partially closed hatch, but the tentacle didn't withdraw. It was incredibly strong and muscular, writhing as he watched, the suckers like small puckered mouths opening and closing. Norman stomped down on the hatch, trying to force the tentacle to withdraw. With a muscular flip, the hatch flew open, knocking him backward, and the tentacle reached up into the habitat. He smelled the strong odor of ammonium. Norman fled, climbing higher into the cylinder. The second tentacle appeared, splashing up through the hatch. The 2 tentacles swung in circles beneath him, searching. He came to a porthole and looked out, saw the great body of the animal, the huge, round, staring eye. He clambered higher, getting away from the tentacles. Most of the cylinder seemed to be given over to storage. It was crammed with equipment, boxes, tanks. Many of the boxes were bright red with stencils. Caution, no smoking, no electronics, TVAC explosives. There were a hell of a lot of explosives in here, he thought, stumbling upward. The tentacles rose higher behind him. Somewhere, in a detached, logical part of his brain, he thought, the cylinder is only 40 feet high, and the tentacles are at least 40 feet long. There will be no place for me to hide. He stumbled, banged his knee, kept going. He heard the slap of the tentacles as they struck the wall, swung upward toward him. A weapon, he thought. I have to find a weapon. He came to the small galley, metal counter, some pots and pans. He pulled the drawers open hastily, looking for a knife. He could find only a small paring knife, threw it away in disgust. He heard the tentacles coming closer. The next moment he was knocked down, his helmet banging on the deck. Norman scrambled to his feet, dodged the tentacle, moved up the cylinder. A communication section, radio set, computer, a couple of monitors. The tentacles were right behind him, slithering up like nightmarish vines. His eyes burned from the ammonia fumes. He came to the bunks, a narrow space near the top of the cylinder. No place to hide, he thought. No weapons, and no place to hide. The tentacles reached the top of the cylinder, slapped against the upper curved surface, swung sideways. In a moment they would have him. He grabbed the mattress from one bunk, held it up as flimsy protection. The two tentacles were swinging erratically around him. He dodged the first, and then with a whoomp, the second tentacle coiled around him, holding both him and the mattress in a cold, slimy grip. He felt a sickening slow squeeze, the dozens of suckers gripping his body, cutting into his skin. He moaned in horror. The second tentacle swung back to grip him along with the first. He was trapped in a vise. Oh, God, he thought. The tentacles swung away from the wall, lifting him high in the air, into the middle of the cylinder. This is it, he thought. But in the next moment he felt his body sliding downward past the mattress, and he slipped through the grip and fell through the air. He grabbed the tentacles for support, sliding down the giant, evil-smelling vines, and then he crashed down onto the deck near the galley, his head banging on the metal deck. He rolled onto his back. He saw the two tentacles above, gripping the mattress, squeezing it, twisting it. Did the squid realize what had happened, that he had gotten free? Norman looked around desperately. A weapon, a weapon. This was a Navy habitat. There must be a weapon somewhere. The tentacles tore the mattress apart. Shreds of white padding drifted down through the cylinder. The tentacles released the mattress, the big pieces falling. Then the tentacles started swinging around the habitat again, searching. It knows, he thought. It knows I have gotten away and that I am still in here somewhere. It is hunting me. But how did it know? Norman ducked behind the galley as one of the flat tentacles came crashing through the pots and pans, sweeping around, feeling for him. Norman scrambled back, coming up against a large potted plant. The tentacle was still searching, moving restlessly across the floor, banging the pans. Norman pushed the plant forward, and the tentacle gripped it, uprooted it easily, sweeping it away into the air. The distraction allowed Norman to scramble forward. A weapon, he thought, a weapon. He looked down to where the mattress had fallen, and he saw, lining the wall near the bottom hatch, a series of silver vertical bars. Spear guns! Somehow he had missed them on the way up. Each spear gun was tipped in a fat bulb, like a hand grenade. Explosive tips? He started to climb down. The tentacles were sliding down, too, following him. How did the squid know where he was? And then, as he passed a porthole, he saw the eye outside, and he thought, he can see me, for God's sake. Stay away from the portholes. Not thinking clearly. Everything happening fast. Crawling down past the explosive crates in the storage hold, thinking, I better not miss in here. And he landed with a clang on the airlock deck. The arms were slithering down, moving down the cylinder toward him. He tugged at one of the spear guns. It was strapped to the wall with a rubber cord. Norman pulled at it, tried to release it. The tentacles drew closer. He yanked at the rubber, but it wouldn't release. What was wrong with these snaps? The tentacles were closer, coming down swiftly. Then he realized the cords had safety catches. You had to pull the gun sideways, not out. He did. The rubber popped free. The spear gun was in his hand. He turned, and the tentacle knocked him down. He flipped onto his back and saw the great, flat, suckered palm of the tentacle coming straight down on him, and the tentacle wrapped over his helmet. Everything was black, and he fired. There was tremendous pain in his chest and abdomen. For a horrified moment, he thought he had shot himself. Then he gasped, and he realized it was just the concussion. His chest was burning, but the squid released him. He still couldn't see. He pulled the palm off his face, and it fell heavily onto the deck, writhing, severed from the squid arm. The interior walls of the habitat were spattered with blood. One tentacle was still moving. The other was a bloody, ragged stump. Both arms pulled out through the hatch, slipped into the water. Norman ran for the porthole. The squid moved swiftly away, the green glow diminishing. He had done it. He'd beaten it off. He'd done it. DH-8. "How many did you bring?" Harry said, turning the spear gun over in his hands. "5, Norman said. "That was all I could carry." "But it worked?" He was examining the bulbous explosive tip. "Yeah, it worked. Blew the whole tentacle off." "I saw the squid going away," Harry said. "I figured you must have done something." "Where's Beth?" "I don't know. Her suit's gone. I think she may have gone to the ship." "Gone to the ship?" Norman said, frowning. "All I know is when I woke up, she was gone. I figured you were over at the habitat, and then I saw the squid, and I tried to get you on the radio, but I guess the metal blocked the transmission." "Beth left?" Norman said. He was starting to get angry. Beth was supposed to stay at the communications console, watching the sensors for him while he was outside. Instead, she had gone to the ship. "Her suit's gone," Harry said again. "Son of a bitch," Norman said. He was suddenly furious. Really, deeply furious. He kicked the console. "Careful there," Harry said. "Damn it." "Take it easy," Harry said. "Come on, take it easy, Norman. What the hell does she think she's doing?" "Come on, sit down, Norman." Harry steered him to a chair. "We're all tired." "Damn right we're tired." "Easy, Norman, easy. Remember your blood pressure." "My blood pressure's fine." "Not now it's not," Harry said. "You're purple." "How could she let me go outside and then just leave?" "Worse, go out herself," Harry said. "But she wasn't watching out for me anymore," Norman said. And then it came to him why he was so angry. He was angry because he was afraid. At a moment of great personal danger, Beth had abandoned him. There were only 3 of them left down there, and they needed each other. They needed to depend on each other. But Beth was unreliable, and that made him afraid and angry. "Can you hear me?" her voice said on the intercom. "Anybody hear me?" Norman reached for the microphone, but Harry snatched it away. "I'll do this," he said. "Yes, Beth, we can hear you." "I'm in the ship," she said, her voice crackling on the intercom. "I found another compartment aft behind the crew bunks. It's quite interesting." Quite interesting, Norman thought. Jesus, quite interesting. He grabbed the microphone from Harry. "Beth, what the hell are you doing over there?"
"Oh, hi, Norman. You made it back okay, huh?"
"Barely." "You have some trouble?" She didn't sound concerned. "Yes, I did."
"Are you all right? You sound mad."
"You bet I'm mad. Beth, why did you leave while I was out there?"
"Harry said he'd take over for me."
"He what?" Norman looked at Harry. Harry was shaking his head no.
"Harry said he'd take over at the console for me. He told me to go ahead to the ship. Since the squid wasn't around, it seemed like a good time."
Norman cupped his hands over the microphone. "I don't remember that," Harry said. "Did you talk to her?"
"I don't remember talking to her."
Beth said, "Just ask him, Norman. He'll tell you." "He says he never said that."
"Well, then he's full of it," Beth said. "What do you think? I'd abandon you when you were outside, for Christ's sake?"
There was a pause.
"I'd never do that, Norman."
"I swear," Harry said to Norman, "I never had any conversation with Beth. I never talked to her at all.
I'm telling you, she was gone when I woke up. There was nobody here.
If you ask me, she always intended to go to the ship." Norman remembered how quickly Beth had agreed to let Norman go to the sub, how surprised he had been. Perhaps Harry was right, he thought. Perhaps Beth had been planning it all along.
"You know what I think?" Harry said. "I think she's cracking up."
Over the intercom, Beth said, "You guys get it straightened out?" Norman said, "I think so, Beth. Yes."
"Good," Beth said.
because I have made a discovery over here in the spaceship.
What's that?
I've found the crew.
You both came, Beth said. She was sitting on a console in the comfortable beige flight deck of the spacecraft.
Yes, Norman said, looking at her. She looked okay. If anything, she looked better than ever, stronger, clearer. She actually looked rather beautiful, he thought.
Harry thought that the squid wouldn't come back.
The squid was out there?
Norman briefly told her about his attack.
Jesus! I'm sorry, Norman. I'd never have left if I had any idea.
She certainly didn't sound like somebody who was cracking up, Norman thought. She sounded appropriate and sincere. Anyway, he said, I injured it and Harry thought it wouldn't come back. Harry said, and we couldn't decide who should stay behind, so we both came.
Well, come this way, Beth said.
She led them back, through the crew quarters, past the 20 bunks for the crew, the large galley. Norman paused at the galley.
So did Harry.
I'm hungry, Harry said.
Eat something, Beth said. I did. They have some sort of nut bars or something. They taste okay.
She opened a drawer in the galley, produced bars wrapped in metal foil, gave them each one. Norman tore the foil and saw something that looked like chocolate. It tasted dry.
Anything to drink?
Sure. She threw open a refrigerator door. Diet Coke?
You're kidding.
The can design is different, and I'm afraid it's warm, but it's Diet Coke, all right.
I'm buying stock in that company, Harry said. Now that we know it'll still be there in 50 years.
He read the can.
Official drink of the Star Voyager Expedition.
Yeah, it's a promo, Beth said. Harry turned the can around. The other side was printed in Japanese.
Wonder what this means.
It means don't buy that stock after all, she said. Norman sipped the Coke with a sense of vague unease. The galley seemed subtly changed from the last time he had seen it. He wasn't sure. He'd only glanced briefly at the room before, but he usually had a good memory for room layouts, and his wife had always joked that Norman could find his way around any kitchen. You know, he said, I don't remember a refrigerator in the galley.
I never really noticed myself, Beth said.
As a matter of fact, Norman said, this whole room looks different to me. It looks bigger and, I don't know, different.
It's 'cause you're hungry, Harry grinned.
Maybe, Norman said. Harry could actually be right. In the 60s, there had been a number of studies of visual perception, which demonstrated that subjects interpreted blurred slides according to their predispositions. Hungry people saw all the slides as food. But this room really did look different. For instance, he didn't remember the door to the galley being to the left, as it was now. He remembered it as being in the center of the wall separating the galley from the bunks.
This way, Beth said, leading them farther aft.
Actually, the refrigerator was what got me thinking. It's one thing to store a lot of food on a test ship being sent through a black hole, but to stock a refrigerator, why bother to do that? It made me think there might be a crew after all.
They entered a short, glass-walled tunnel. Deep purple lights glowed down on them.
Ultraviolet, Beth said. I don't know what it's for.
Disinfection?
Maybe.
Maybe it's to get a suntan, Harry said. Vitamin D.
Then they came into a large room, unlike anything Norman had ever seen. The floor glowed purple, bathing the room in ultraviolet light from beneath. Mounted on all four walls were a series of wide glass tubes. Inside each tube was a narrow silver mattress. The tubes all appeared empty.
Over here, Beth said.
They peered through one glass tube. The naked woman had once been beautiful. It was still possible to see that. Her skin was dark brown and deeply wrinkled. Her body withered.
Mummified? Harry said.
Beth nodded.
Best I can figure out. I haven't opened the tube, considering the risk of infection.
What was this room? He said, looking around.
It must be some kind of hibernation chamber. Each tube is separately connected to a life support system, power supply, air handlers, heaters, the works. In the next room.
Harry counted.
20 tubes,
he said. And 20 bunks, Norman said.
So where is everybody else?
Beth shook her head.
I don't know. This woman is the only one left?
Looks like it.
I haven't found any others.
I wonder how they all died, Harry said. Have you been to the Sphere? Norman asked Beth.
No, why?
Just wondered.
You mean you wondered if the crew died after they picked up the Sphere?
Basically, yes. I don't think the Sphere is aggressive or dangerous in any sense, Beth said. It's possible that the crew died of natural causes in the course of the journey itself. This woman, for example, is so well preserved it makes you wonder about radiation. Maybe she got a large dose of radiation. There's tremendous radiation around a black hole. You think the crew died going through the black hole, and the Sphere was picked up automatically by the spacecraft later?
It's possible.
She's pretty good looking, Harry said, peering through the glass. Boy, the reporters would go crazy with this, wouldn't they? Sexy woman from the future found nude and mummified. Film at 11.
She's tall, too, Norman said. She must be over 6 feet.
An Amazon woman, Harry said, with great tits.
All right, Beth said.
What's wrong? Offended on her behalf? Harry said.
I don't think there's any need for comments of that kind.
Actually, Beth, Harry said, she looks a little like you.
Beth frowned.
I'm serious. Have you looked at her?
Don't be ridiculous.
Norman peered through the glass, shielding his hand against the reflection of the purple UV tubes in the floor. The mummified woman did indeed look like Beth. Younger, taller, stronger, but like Beth, nevertheless.
He's right, Norman said.
Maybe she's you from the future, Harry said.
No, she's obviously in her 20s.
Maybe she's your granddaughter.
Pretty unlikely, Beth said.
You never know, Harry said. Does Jennifer look like you?
Not really, but she's at that awkward stage, and she doesn't look like that woman, and neither do I.
Norman was struck by the conviction with which Beth denied any resemblance or association to the mummified woman.
Beth, he said, what do you suppose happened here? Why is this woman the only one left?
I think she was important to the expedition, Beth said. Maybe even the captain or the co-captain. The others were mostly men, and they did something foolish, I don't know what, something she advised them against, and as a result they all died. She alone remained alive in this spacecraft, and she piloted it home. But there was something wrong with her, something she couldn't help, and she died.
What was wrong with her?
I don't know, something.
Fascinating, Norman thought. He'd never really considered it before, but this room, for that matter, this entire spacecraft, was one big Rorschach, or more accurately, a TAT, the thematic apperception test. Was a psychological test that consisted of a series of ambiguous pictures. Subjects were supposed to tell what they thought was happening in the pictures. Since no clear story was implied by the pictures, the subjects supplied the stories. And the stories told much more about the storytellers than about the pictures. Now Beth was telling them her fantasy about this room. That a woman had been in charge of the expedition, the men had failed to listen to her, they had died, and she alone had remained alive, the sole survivor. It didn't tell them much about this spaceship, but it told them a lot about Beth.
I get it, Harry said. You mean she's the one who made the mistake and piloted the ship back too far into the past. Typical woman driver.
Do you have to make a joke of everything?
Do you have to take everything so seriously?
This is serious, Beth said.
I'll tell you a different story. Harry said. This woman screwed up. She was supposed to do something, and she forgot to do it, or else she made a mistake. And then she went into hibernation. As a result of her mistake, the rest of the crew died, and she never woke up from the hibernation, never realized what she had done, because she was so unaware of what was really happening.
I'm sure you like that story better, Beth said. It fits with your typical black male contempt for women.
Easy, Norman said.
You resent the power of the female, Beth said.
What power? You call lifting weights power? That's only strength, and it comes out of a feeling of weakness, not power.
You skinny little weasel, Beth said.
What are you going to do, beat me up? Harry said. Is that your idea of power?
I know what power is, Beth said, glaring at him.
Easy, easy, Norman said. Let's not get into this. Harry said, what do you think, Norman? Do you have a story about the room, too?
No, Norman said, I don't.
Oh, come on, Harry said. I bet you do.
No, Norman said, and I'm not going to mediate between you two. We've all got to stay together on this. We have to work as a team as long as we're down here.
It's Harry who's divisive, Beth said. From the beginning of this trip, he's tried to make trouble with everybody. All those snide little comments.
What snide little comments?
Harry said.
You know perfectly well what snide little comments, Beth said.
Norman walked out of the room.
Where are you going?
Your audience is leaving.
Why?
Because you're both boring.
Oh, Beth said. Mr. Cool Psychologist decides we are boring?
That's right, Norman said, walking through the glass tunnel, not looking back.
Where do you get off making all these judgments of other people?
Beth shouted at him. He kept walking.
I'm speaking to you. Don't you walk away while I'm speaking to you, Norman.
He came into the galley once more and started opening the drawers, looking for the nut bars. He was hungry again, and the search took his mind off the other two. He had to admit he was disturbed by the way things were going. He found a bar, tore the foil, ate it. Disturbed, but not surprised. In studies of group dynamics, he had long ago verified the truth of the old statement, three is a crowd. For a high-tension situation, groups of three were inherently unstable. Unless everybody had clearly defined responsibilities, the group tended to form shifting allegiances, two against one. That was what was happening now. He finished the nut bar and immediately ate another one. How much longer did they have down here? At least 36 hours more. He looked for a place to carry additional nut bars, but his polyester jumpsuit had no pockets. Beth and Harry came into the galley, much chagrined.
Want a nut bar? He said, chewing.
We want to apologize, she said.
For what?
For acting like children, Harry said.
I'm embarrassed, Beth said. I feel terrible about losing my temper that way. I feel like a complete idiot.
Beth was hanging her head, staring at the floor.
Interesting how she flipped, he thought, from aggressive self-confidence to the complete opposite, abject self-apology. Nothing in between.
Let's not take it too far, he said. We're all tired.
I feel just awful, Beth continued. Really awful. I feel as if I've let you both down. I shouldn't be here in the first place. I'm not worthy to be in this group.
Norman said, Beth, have a nut bar and stop feeling sorry for yourself.
Yes, Harry said. I think I like you better angry.
I'm sick of those nut bars, Beth said.
Before you came here, I ate 11 of them.
Well, make it an even dozen, Norman said, and we'll go back to the habitat.
Walking back across the ocean floor, they were tense, watching for the squid. But Norman derived comfort from the fact that they were armed. And something else, some inner confidence that came from his earlier confrontation with the squid.
You hold that spear gun like you mean it, Beth said.
Yes, I guess so.
All his life he had been an academic, a university researcher, and had never conceived of himself as a man of action, at least nothing beyond the occasional game of golf. Now, holding the spear gun ready, he found he rather liked the feeling. As he walked, he noticed the profusion of sea fans on the path between the spacecraft and the habitat. They were obliged to walk around the fans, which were sometimes 4 and 5 feet tall, gaudy purple and blue in their lights. Norman was quite sure that the fans had not been down here when they first arrived at the habitat. Now there were not only colorful fans, but schools of large fish, too. Most of the fish were black, with a reddish stripe across the back. Beth said they were Pacific surgeon fish, normal for the region.
Everything is changing, he thought. It's all changing around us. But he wasn't sure about that. He didn't really trust his memory down here. There were too many other things to alter his perceptions. The high-pressure atmosphere, the injuries he had received, and the nagging tension and fear he lived with. Something pale caught his eye. Shining his light down on the bottom, he saw a wriggling white streak with a long thin fin and black stripes. At first he thought it was an eel. Then he saw the tiny head, the mouth. "Just wait," Beth said, putting her arm on him. "What is it?" "Sea snake." "Are they dangerous?" "Not usually." "Poisonous?" Harry said. "Very poisonous." The snake stayed close to the bottom, apparently looking for food. The snake ignored them entirely, and Norman found it quite beautiful to watch, particularly as it moved farther away. "It gives me the creeps," Beth said. "Do you know what kind it is?" Norman said. "It may be a belcher's," Beth said. "Pacific sea snakes are all poisonous, but belcher sea snake is the most poisonous. In fact, some researchers think it's the deadliest reptile in the world, with venom 100 times more powerful than the venom of a king cobra or the black tiger snake." "So if it bit you..." 2 minutes, tops." They watched the snake slither away among the fans. Then it was gone. "Sea snakes are not usually aggressive," Beth said. "Some divers even touch them, play with them, but I never would. God, snakes!" "Why are they so poisonous? Is it for immobilizing prey?" "You know, it's interesting," Beth said, "but the most toxic creatures in the world are all water creatures. The venom of land animals is nothing in comparison. And even among land animals, the most deadly poison is derived from an amphibian, a toad, Bufotenae marfensis. In the sea, there are poisonous fish, like the blowfish, which is a delicacy in Japan. There are poisonous shells, like the star cone, Alavertus lutensis. Once I was on a boat in Guam and a woman brought up a star cone. The shells are very beautiful, but she didn't know you have to keep your fingers away from the point. The animal extruded its poison spine and stung her in the palm. She took 3 steps before she collapsed in convulsions, and she died within an hour. There are also poisonous plants, poisonous sponges, poisonous corals, and then the snakes. Even the weakest of the sea snakes are invariably lethal." "Nice," Harry said. "Well, you have to recognize that the ocean is a much older living environment than the land. There's been life in the oceans for 3.5 billion years, much longer than on land. The methods of competition and defense are much more highly developed in the ocean. There's been more time." "You mean a few billion years from now, there will be tremendously poisonous animals on land, too?" "If we get that far," she said. "Let's just get back to the habitat," Harry said. The habitat was now very close. They could see all the streaming bubbles rising from the leaks. "Leaking like a bastard," Harry said. "I think we've got enough air. I think I'll check." "Be my guest," Beth said, "but I did a thorough job." Norman thought another argument was about to start, but Beth and Harry dropped it. They came to the hatch and climbed up into DH-8. The console. "Jerry?" Norman stared at the console screen. It remained blank, just a blinking cursor. "Jerry, are you there?" The screen was blank. "I wonder why we aren't hearing from you, Jerry," Norman said. The screen remained blank. "Trying a little psychology?" Beth said. She was checking the controls for the external sensors, reviewing the graphs. "If you ask me, the person you should use your psychology on is Harry." "What do you mean?" "What I mean is, I don't think Harry should be screwing around with our life support systems. I don't think he's stable."
"Stable?"
"That's a psychologist's trick, isn't it? To repeat the last word in a sentence. It's a way to keep the person talking."
"Talking?" Norman said, smiling at her.
"Okay, maybe I am a little stressed out," she said. "But Norman, seriously, before I left for the ship, Harry came into this room and said he would take over for me. I told him you were at the sub, but there weren't any squid around and that I wanted to go to the ship. He said fine, he'd take over, so I left. And now he doesn't remember any of that. Doesn't that strike you as pretty screwy?
Screwy, Norman said.
Stop it, be serious.
Serious? Norman said.
Are you trying to avoid this conversation? I notice how you avoid what you don't want to talk about. You keep everybody on an even keel, steer the conversation away from hard topics. But I think you should listen to what I'm saying, Norman. There's a problem with Harry.
I'm listening to what you're saying, Beth.
And?
I wasn't present for this particular episode, so I don't really know. What I see of Harry now looks like the same old Harry. Arrogant, disdainful, and very, very intelligent.
You don't think he's cracking up?
No more than the rest of us.
Jesus, what do I have to do to convince you? I had a whole conversation with the man, and now he denies it. You think that's normal? You think we can trust a person like that?
Beth, I wasn't there.
You mean it might be me?
I wasn't there.
You think I might be the one who's cracking up?
I say there was a conversation when there really wasn't?
Beth. Norman, I'm telling you. There is a problem about Harry, and you aren't facing up to it.
They heard footsteps approaching. I'm going to my lab, she said. You think about what I've said. She climbed the ladder as Harry walked in.
Well, guess what? Beth did an excellent job with the life support systems. Everything looks fine. We have air for 52 hours more at present rates of consumption. We should be fine.
You talking to Jerry?
What?
Norman said.
Harry pointed to the screen.
Hello, Norman.
I don't know when he came back. He wasn't talking earlier.
Well, he is now, Harry said.
Hello, Harry.
How's it going, Jerry?
Harry said.
Fine, thank you. How are you? I am wanting so much to talk with your entities. Where is the control entity Harold C. Barnes?
Don't you know?
I do not sense that entity now.
He's gone.
I see. He was not friendly. He did not enjoy to talk with me.
Norman thought, what is he telling us? Did Jerry get rid of Barnes because he thought he was unfriendly?
Jerry, Norman said, what happened to the control entity?
He was not friendly. I did not like him.
Yes, but what happened to him?
He is not now.
And the other entities?
And the other entities. They did not enjoy to talking with me.
Harry said, you think he's saying he got rid of them?
I am not happy to talking with them.
So he got rid of all the Navy people?
Harry said. Norman was thinking, that's not quite correct. He also got rid of Ted, and Ted was trying to communicate with him, or with the squid.
Was the squid related to Jerry?
How would Norman ask that?
Jerry.
Yes, Norman, I am here.
Let's talk.
Good. I like that much.
Tell us about the squid, Jerry.
The entity squid is a manifestation.
Where did it come from?
Do you like it? I can manifest it more for you.
No, no, don't do that, Norman said quickly.
You do not like it?
No, no, we like it, Jerry.
This is true?
Yes, true. We like it. Really, we do.
Good. I am pleased you like it. It is a very impressive entity of large size.
Yes, it is, Norman said, wiping sweat from his forehead. Jesus, he thought, this is like talking to a child with a loaded gun.
It is difficult for me to manifest this large entity. I am pleased that you like it,
Very impressive, Norman agreed. But you do not need to repeat that entity for us.
You wish a new entity manifested for you?
No, Jerry. Nothing right now, thank you.
Manifesting is happy for me.
Yes, I'm sure it is. I am enjoying to manifest for you, Norman, and also for you, Harry. Thank you, Jerry. I am enjoying your manifestations also.
Our manifestations? Norman said, glancing at Harry.
Apparently, Jerry thought that the people on the habitat were manifesting something in return. Jerry seemed to consider it an exchange of some kind. Yes, I am enjoying your manifestations also. Tell us about our manifestations, Jerry, Norman said. The manifestations are small, and they do not extend beyond your entities, but the manifestations are new for me. They are happy for me.
What's he talking about? Harry said.
Your manifestations, Harry.
What manifestations, for Christ's sake?
Don't get mad, Norman warned. Stay calm.
I am liking that one, Harry. Do another.
Norman thought, is he reading emotions? Does he regard our emotions as manifestations? But that didn't make sense. Jerry couldn't read their minds. They'd already determined that. Maybe he'd better check again. Jerry, he thought, can you hear me?
I am liking Harry. His manifestations are red. They are witful.
Witful?
Witful equals full of wit?
I see, Harry said. He thinks we're funny.
Funny equals full of fun?
Not exactly, Norman said.
We entities have the concept of...
He trailed off.
How was he going to explain funny? What was a joke anyway? We entities have the concept of a situation which causes discomfort, and we call this situation humorous.
Hum or us?
No, one word. Norman spelled it for him.
I see. Your manifestations are humorous. The entity Squid makes many humorous manifestations from you.
We don't think so, Harry said.
I think so.
And that about summed it up, Norman thought, sitting at the console. Somehow he had to make Jerry understand the seriousness of his actions.
Jerry, Norman explained, your manifestations injure our entities. Some of our entities are already gone.
Yes, I know.
If you continue your manifestations...
Yes, I am liking to manifest. It is humorous for you.
Then pretty soon all our entities will be gone, and then there will be no one to talk to you.
I do not wish that.
I know that, but many entities are gone already.
Bring them back.
We can't do that. They are gone forever.
Why?
We cannot bring them back.
Why?
Just like a kid, Norman thought. Just exactly like a kid. Telling the kid you can't do what he wants, you can't play the way he wants to play, and he refuses to accept it.
We do not have the power, Jerry, to bring them back.
I wish you to bring the other entities back now.
He thinks we're refusing to play, Harry said.
Bring back the entity, Ted.
Norman said, we can't, Jerry. We would if we could.
I am liking the entity, Ted. He is very humorous.
Yes, Norman said. Ted liked you, too. Ted was trying to talk to you.
Yes, I am liking his manifestations. Bring back Ted.
We can't.
There was a long pause. I am offended, you?
No, not at all. We are friends, Norman and Harry.
Yes, we are.
Then bring back the entities.
He just refuses to understand, Harry said. Jerry, for God's sake, we can't do it.
You are humorous, Harry. Make it again.
He's definitely reading strong emotional reactions as some kind of manifestation, Norman thought. Was this his idea of play? To make a provocation to the other party, and then to be amused by their responses? Was he delighted to see the vivid emotions brought on by the squid? Was this his idea of a game?
Harry, make it again. Harry, make it again.
Hey, man, Harry said angrily. Get off my back.
Thank you. I am liking that. It was red also.
Now you will please bring back the entities gone.
Norman had an idea.
Jerry, he said, if you wish the entities back, why don't you bring them back?
I am not pleased to do this.
But you could do it if you wanted to.
I can do anything.
Yes, of course you can. So why don't you bring back the entities you desire?
No, I am not happy to do this.
Why not? Harry said.
Hey, man, get off my back.
No offense, Jerry, Norman said quickly. There was no reply on the screen. Jerry? The screen did not respond.
He's gone again, Harry said. He shook his head. God knows what the little bastard will do next.
Further analysis.
Norman went up to the lab to see Beth. But she was asleep, curled up on her couch. In sleep, she looked quite beautiful. It was odd, after all the time down here, she should seem so radiant. It was as if the harshness had gone out of her features. Her nose did not seem so sharp anymore. The line of the mouth was softer, fuller. He looked at her arms, which had been sinewy, veins bulging. The muscles seemed smoother, more feminine somehow. Who knows, he thought. After so many hours down here, you're no judge of anything. He climbed back down the ladder and went to his bunk. Harry was already there, snoring loudly. Norman decided to take another shower. As he stepped into the spray, he made a startling discovery. The bruises which had covered his body were gone. Anyway, almost gone, he thought, staring down at the remaining patches of yellow and purple. They had healed within hours. He moved his limbs experimentally and realized that the pain had gone, too. Why? What had happened? For a moment he thought this was all a dream or a nightmare, and then he thought, no, it's just the atmosphere. Cuts and bruises healing faster in the high-pressure environment. It wasn't anything mysterious, just an atmospheric effect. He toweled himself as dry as he could with the damp towel, and then went back to his bunk. Harry was still snoring, as loud as ever. Norman lay on his back, stared at the red humming coils of the ceiling heater. He had an idea, and got out of bed, and shifted Harry's talker from the base of his throat to one side. Immediately, the snores changed to a soft, high-pitched hiss. Much better, he thought. He lay on the damp pillow, and was almost immediately asleep. He awoke with no sense of passing time. It might have been only a few seconds. But he felt refreshed. He stretched and yawned and got out of bed. Harry still slept. Norman moved the talker back, and the snores resumed. He went into D-cell to the console. Still on the screen were the words, "Hey, man, get off my back." "Jerry," Norman said. "Are you there, Jerry?" The screen did not respond. Jerry wasn't there. Norman looked at the stack of printouts to one side. I really should go over this stuff, he thought, because something troubled him about Jerry. Norman couldn't put his finger on it, but even if one imagined the alien as a spoiled child king, Jerry's behavior didn't make sense.
It just didn't add up, including the last message. Hey, man, get off my back.
Street talk? Or just imitating Harry? In any case, it wasn't Jerry's usual mode of communication. Usually, Jerry was ungrammatical and sort of spacey, talking about entities and awareness. But from time to time, he would become sharply colloquial. Norman looked at the sheets. We'll be right back after a short break for these messages from our sponsor. That was one example. Where had that come from? It sounded like Johnny Carson. Then why didn't Jerry sound like Johnny Carson all the time? What caused the shift? Then, too, there was the problem of the squid. If Jerry liked to scare them, if he enjoyed rattling their cage and seeing them jump, why use a squid? Where did that idea come from? And why only a squid? Jerry seemed to enjoy manifesting different things. So, why hadn't he produced giant squid one time, great white sharks another time, and so on? Wouldn't that provide a greater challenge to his abilities? Then there was the problem of Ted. Ted had been playing with Jerry at the time he was killed. If Jerry liked to play so much, why would he kill off a player? It just didn't make sense. Or did it? Norman sighed. His trouble lay in his assumptions. Norman was assuming that the alien had logical processes similar to his own. But that might not be true. For one thing, Jerry might operate at a much faster metabolic rate, and thus have a different sense of time. Kids played with a toy only until they got tired of it. Then they changed to another. The hours that seemed so painfully long to Norman might be only a few seconds in the consciousness of Jerry. He might just be playing with the squid for a few seconds until he dropped it for another toy. Kids also had a poor idea about breaking things. If Jerry didn't know about death, then he wouldn't mind killing Ted because he would think the death was just a temporary event, a humorous manifestation by Ted. He might not realize he was actually breaking his toys. And it was also true, when he thought about it, that Jerry had manifested different things. Assuming that the jellyfish and the shrimps and the sea fans and now the sea snakes were his manifestations, were they? Or were they just normal parts of the environment? Was there any way to tell? And the Navy seaman, he thought suddenly. Let's not forget the seaman. Where had he come from? Was that seaman another of Jerry's manifestations? Could Jerry manifest his playmates at will? In that case, he really wouldn't care if he killed them all. But I think that's clear, Norman thought. Jerry doesn't care if he kills us. He just wants to play. And he doesn't know his own strength. Yet there was something else. He scanned the sheets of printout, feeling instinctively some underlying organization to everything. Something he wasn't getting. Some connection he wasn't making. As he thought about it, he kept coming back to one question. Why a squid? Why a squid? Of course, he thought, they had been talking about a squid during the conversation at dinner. Jerry must have overheard that. He must have decided that a squid would be a provocative item to manifest. And he was certainly right about that. Norman shifted the papers and came upon the very first message that Harry had decoded. Hello. How are you? I am fine. What is your name? My name is Jerry. That was as good a place to begin as any. It had been quite a feat for Harry to decode it, Norman thought. If Harry hadn't succeeded with that, they would never have ever started talking to Jerry at all. Norman sat at the console, stared at the keyboard. What had Harry said? The keyboard was a spiral. The letter G was 1, and B was 2, and so on. Very clever to figure it out. Norman would never have figured that out in a million years. He started trying to find the letters in the first sequence. 00032125252632. 032629. 301321, 04261037, 18, 30160, 06180, 82132, 29033005, 1822, 04261013, 08301621371, 1604, 08301621, 1822, 03301313042.
Let's see. 00 marked the beginning of the message, Harry had said. And 03, that was H. And then 21, that was E. Then 25 was L. And 25 was another L. And just above it, 26 was O. Hello. Yes, it all fitted. He continued translating. 032629 was how are you? So far, so good. Norman experienced a certain pleasure, almost as if he were decoding it himself for the first time. Now, 18, that was I. I am fine. He moved more quickly, writing down the letters. What is your name? Now, 1604 was my name is. But then he found a mistake in one letter. Was that possible? Norman kept going, found a second mistake, then wrote out the message and stared at it in growing shock. My name is Harry. Jesus Christ, he said. He went over it again, but there was no mistake, not by him. The message was perfectly clear. Hello, how are you? I am fine. What is your name? My name is Harry. The Power. The Shadow. Beth sat up in her bed in the laboratory and stared at the message Norman had given her. Oh, my God, she said. She pushed her thick dark hair away from her face. How can it be? She said. It all goes together, Norman said. Just think. When did the messages start? After Harry came out of the sphere. When did the squid and the other animals first appear? After Harry came out of the sphere. Yes, but at first there were little squid, but then when we were going to eat them, suddenly there were shrimps, too, just in time for dinner. Why? Because Harry doesn't like to eat squid. Beth said nothing. She just listened. And who, as a child, was terrified by the giant squid in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? Harry was, she said. I remember he said that. Norman went on in a rush. And when does Jerry appear on the screen? When Harry is present, not at other times. And when does Jerry answer us as we talk? When Harry is in the room to hear what we're saying. And why can't Jerry read our minds? Because Harry can't read our minds. And remember how Barnes kept asking for the name, and Harry wouldn't ask for the name? Why? Because he was afraid the screen would say, Harry, not Jerry.
And the crewman?
Right, the black crewman, who shows up just as Harry is having a dream of being rescued. A black crewman shows up to rescue us. Beth was frowning, thinking.
What about the giant squid?
Well, in the middle of its attack, Harry hit his head and was knocked unconscious. Immediately, the squid disappeared. It didn't come back again until Harry woke up from his nap and told you he'd take over.
My God, Beth said.
Yes, Norman said. It explains a lot. She was silent for a while, staring at the message.
But how is he doing it?
I doubt if he is, at least not consciously. Norman had been thinking about this. Let's assume, he said, that something happened to Harry when he went inside the sphere. He acquired some kind of power while in the sphere.
Like what?
The power to make things happen just by thinking of them. The power to make his thoughts real.
Beth frowned. Make his thoughts real?
It's not so strange, he said. Just think, if you were a sculptor, first you would get an idea, and then you would carve it in stone or wood to make it real. The idea comes first, then the execution follows, with some added effort to create a reality that reflects your prior thoughts. That's the way the world works for us.
We imagine something, and then we try to make it happen. Sometimes the way we make it happen is unconscious. Like the guy who just happens to go home unexpectedly at lunchtime and catches his wife in bed with another man. He doesn't consciously plan it. It just sort of happens by itself. Or the wife who catches the husband in bed with another woman. That's it. Yes, of course. The point is, we manage to make things happen all the time without thinking about them too much. I don't think of every word when I talk to you. I just intend to say something, and it comes out okay.
Yes.
So we can make complicated creations like sentences without effort, but we can't make other complicated creations like sculptures without effort. We believe we have to do something besides simply have an idea.
And we do, Beth said.
Well, Harry doesn't. Harry's gone one step further. He doesn't have to carve the statue anymore. He just gets the idea, and things happen by themselves. He manifests things.
Harry imagines a frightening squid, and suddenly we have a frightening squid outside our window?
Exactly. And when he loses consciousness, the squid disappears.
And he got this power from the sphere?
Yes.
Beth frowned. Why is he doing this? Is he trying to kill us?
Norman shook his head. No, I think he's in over his head.
How do you mean?
Well, Norman said, we've considered lots of ideas of what the sphere from another civilization might be. Ted thought it was a trophy or a message. He saw it as a present. Harry thought it had something inside. He saw it as a container. But I wonder if it might be a mine.
You mean an explosive?
Not exactly, but a defense. Or a test. An alien civilization could strew these things around the galaxy, and any intelligence that picks them up would get to experience the power of the sphere, which is that whatever you think comes true. If you think positive thoughts, you get delicious shrimp for dinner. If you think negative thoughts, you get monsters trying to kill you. Same process, just a matter of content. So the same way a landmine blows up if you step on it, this sphere destroys people if they have negative thoughts? Or, he said, if they simply aren't in control of their consciousness. Because if you're in control of your consciousness, the sphere would have no particular effect. If you're not in control, it gets rid of you.
How can you control a negative thought? Beth said.
She seemed suddenly very agitated. How can you say to someone, don't think of a giant squid? The minute you say that, they automatically think of a squid in the course of trying not to think of it.
It's possible to control your thoughts, Norman said. Maybe for a yogi or something.
For anybody, Norman said. It's possible to deflect your attention from undesirable thoughts. How do people quit smoking? How do any of us ever change our minds about anything? By controlling our thoughts.
I still don't see why Harry is doing this.
End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.